This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
Hebrews chapter 7. Boy, do I have some reading for you to do. I'm going to need your mind engaged. I got more text than usual. And you see, it's smaller than usual. So if you have to squint, and this is hard for you, you might want to find it, you know, closer to you and put on your spectacles and also, you know, put on your thinking cap a little. I mean, this is where we are. And it's sort of a part two of what we were talking about last week in Hebrews chapter 7. And I'm just going to read it and then let's just see where we go with it. For this Melchizedek. Whoa, stop. What? Am I in the right place? Is this the Bible? Well, see, when we ended the last passage, you know, he had said, we were talking about priesthood last week, that this was Christ is a priest, the high priest in the order of Melchizedek. So that's what he's talking about. I'm just picking it up. We're doing all of chapter 7, by the way. I'm doing the whole chapter. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to Abraham apportioned Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is, that is Melchizedek, he is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. That's what Melchizedek means. And then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. But resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. See how great this man was, to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. In the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in the other case, by one of whom it is testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there be? What further need would there have been for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek rather than the one named after the order of Aaron? For when there is a change in the priesthood, there is necessarily a change in the law as well. For the one of whom these things are spoken belonged to another tribe, that is, not Levi, from which no one has ever served at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah. And in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. This becomes even more evident when another priest arises in the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become a priest, not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning his bodily descent, that is, not because he's a Levite, not because he's from Aaron, but by the power of an indestructible life, for it is witnessed of him. And here comes the psalm. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, a former commandment is set aside because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. But on the other hand, a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. And it is not without an oath. For those who formerly became priests were made such without an oath, but this one was made priest with an oath by the one who said to him, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, you are a priest forever." This makes Jesus the guarantor of a better covenant. The former priests were many in number because they were prevented by death from continuing in office. But he holds his priesthood permanently, because he continues forever. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins, and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all, when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Thus says the word of God. And that's a mouthful and several slides full. But just to review, the concept of priesthood we introduced last week because the writer of Hebrews introduced it last week. So we did. Because we're just following his lead here. The concept of priesthood. You remember I said priesthood is very basic. It's sort of universal. In the basic religious impulse of man and the religious intuitions of man, priesthood is always there. That's why you find priesthood among all cultures. You find priesthood in some of the great religions with numerous people. And you find priesthood in tiny tribal religions here and there. Priesthood is not something, the concept itself wasn't specially revealed. It's sort of in the nature and the heart of man to look for a person to set apart, to look for a mediator, to be right with God so that God will accept you. He goes to God for you and he comes to you for God and he stands in between and you bring the sacrifices and he goes in and does it because he's specially set apart to do it. And you find this everywhere. It's fairly basic. And Israel had such a thing, had a priesthood instituted during the time of Moses. Remember, he looks back. He says, yeah, see, you had Moses. The law is given at that time. And as part of the law, as part of that whole system, he says, you're going to have a priesthood. So take your brother, Aaron, set him apart, him and his sons. They're going to be priests. And since we're going to have a tabernacle, there's going to be a lot of functionality. They're going to need a lot of people. Everyone belonging to his tribe, and he happens to be of the tribe of Levi. Remember, you got those 12 tribes. All Jews belong to one. And all his people, the Levites, they'll sort of serve that role. They'll be specially set apart to serve in and around that area and do all that stuff. And only Aaron and his sons will have this special calling. You can't run for priest, okay? You can't, it's not a democracy. You can't just take it over because you have more power. You can't buy the office because you have a lot of money. None of that works. You're from Aaron. Your descendancy comes from there. That's how that works. And then you can be a priest. Of course, you have to do everything just so and keep your nose clean and do everything right, or you befoul the whole office and you corrupt it, which did happen. Because anytime you have human beings serving in various offices, you get some that are pretty good, okay, not too bad, and some of them are rotten. The priesthood is a very human institution. And thereby was its weakness. So that's how that worked. And we sort of walked through it and we looked at it. And because the writer went back to look at that. But now here we are, chapter 7. And now he's going to introduce something, or I should say someone, very, we could say mysterious. He introduces a name, a character, that is probably hardly known to people. Especially now because, you know, our culture is not very literate in the Bible anymore. So our culture, if it knows anything about the Bible, it knows about the fourth grade Sunday school level of Bible and no more. So you say Noah, they say, yeah, built an ark. You say Melchizedek, they say, what? Who? And sadly, even among churchgoers, probably a name they might wonder. Oh, is that a Bible character? You sure? Don't recognize. Well, there's a reason why maybe not. I mean, he's not mentioned very often. This person is mentioned, here's the sum total of it, once briefly in Genesis, which the writer of Hebrews is referring back to that occasion and retelling that account. He's mentioned there briefly. He's mentioned in one verse in a psalm, which is quoted in Hebrews 7. And that's it. That's it for him. Until you get to Hebrews, you know. And then you get all this stuff on him. But before that, that's it. That's all we know of him. Furthermore, it's just some real gaping holes as to who he is. Well, I'm going to read to you. And you don't have to look it up, but you can. I don't have it on the slide, but I'm going to read to you from Genesis 14, just so you hear the original account where Melchizedek turns up in the story. He's there, and then he's gone. And it happens in the life of Abraham, who, this is early on, he's still referred to in this passage as Abram. And this is after he's gone to have battle, right? And thankfully, he's victorious in battle. By God's help, he wins, and so he's ready. He's in a thankful mood. He's ready to offer up some of the spoils. But you know, there's no temple. There's no priesthood. There's no law been given. There's none of that stuff yet. But here it is, Genesis 14, starting in verse 17. After his return, talking about Abraham, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, if you're looking for a unique baby name, I'm just going to, a Bible name, Chedorlaomer. Okay. And the kings who were with him after this defeat, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. Here it is. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. There it is. That's the account to which our writer refers. Right there. How about this? Abram coming across a man. What about that psalm he quotes? I'll read that to you as well. A psalm which has decidedly messianic overtones. As far as Israel was understood it, the Messiah was supposed to be a king, was he not? He was going to come and be a king. He was going to rule. A special anointed king. He's going to sit on the throne of David. David who wrote this psalm I'm about to read. He's going to sit on the throne of David. He will come from that same tribe David came from, of course, Judah. He's the lion of Judah. He's from the root of Jesse, right? David's father. So, here's the Psalm of David, Psalm 110, and we got a little bit of it quoted in Hebrews 7, but here's more. Here's what it says. I mean, it starts, "The Lord said to my Lord," Lord in all caps, "said to my Lord," not all caps. What's that mean? It means Yahweh says to my Lord, lower caps, Adonai. "The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand, and I will make your enemies your footstool. The Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies." That sounds like a king to me. That sounds like a powerful ruler. A powerful king, doesn't it? "Your enemies will be your footstool. Your mighty scepter. You will rule in the midst of your enemies." He's a king. But he's not just a king. For then you get to this other verse quoted. Verse 4, "The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." So Psalm 110, with this messianic prophetic tone in it, says, you're a mighty king with a powerful scepter, and God also swore this to you, and it's no mistake, and he ain't going to change it. You're a priest. After the order of Melchizedek, and there's the mention of the man from Genesis 14, and the only mention in all of the Hebrew scriptures. Well, what about this? Were the kings in Israel, did the kings of Israel function as priests? Did they just go down to the temple and function as priests? No. Did the priest decide, we'll be the political leader and take over as king? These are two offices. They're separate offices. But here they're united. But there are other places with this similar idea. So Zechariah, prophet who comes much later, after the exile, Zechariah has this little messianic passage as well, a little prophetic passage in chapter 6, verse 13, and it says, "He will build the temple of the Lord and rule upon his throne." There you have it right there. The temple, the throne. The priest, the king. And then Zechariah says, Thus he shall be a priest on his throne. A priest on his throne. And the council of peace will be between the two offices. That's a pretty amazing verse. That's pretty amazing. The two offices are now peacefully united in this figure, in this great messianic figure. A king priest or a priest king, a hyphenated office. They're brought together. So there you have it. So then, the writer of Hebrews goes back to the two places where this guy appears. And he references and quotes them both. And he has, of course, a very important point to make here. So who then is our mystery man? Who is the ancient Near Eastern man of mystery, this enigmatic figure? What is said about him? Well, the writer here decides to just sort of lay it all out. So let's consider some of the things that Hebrews 7 tells us about Melchizedek. Some of the specific things about him. He just goes through several points here and says, let's look at who this guy is. First of all, he just starts with his name. You know, in Hebrew, names had meanings. I mean, you all know this. Names had meanings. So his name has a meaning. The word in Hebrew for king is Melech. Melech is a king. And Zadok is righteousness or righteous. Melchizedek, king of righteousness. So his name has a sort of an important and royal sounding meaning to it. He says, well, that's what his name means. Also, though, he is called a king of a place. What kind of place? Salem. Is there a Salem? There certainly was a Salem at this time. It wasn't too far from there. So there literally was a Salem. You know how you can really know there was a Salem? Because later, this name is part of a larger name that you're more familiar with, known as Yerushalem, Jerusalem. The word Salem means peace. So that's why he says, yeah, he's also the king of peace. Salem means peace. It's the same root as shalom that we hear people say, right? And even in Arabic as well. That's why you hear Muslims greet each other and say salam, right? This means peace. So he's going to give us that much too. So you can sort of just see the bullet points. And I just sort of lay it out. By the way, the slide I have for this, I didn't create. I always sort of give credit to the vast world of the internet. I think I have a slide for this. We shall see when Trisha wakes up. Anyway, too much steak and gravy this morning? I saw you eating that back there, by the way. It smelled pretty good. I stole a bite while you weren't looking. Let's go on. So, how about this? I couldn't resist. It's classical. It's just a classical beauty. So, the representation of one man. One man's interpretive opinion. One man's creative choice. The great Flemish painter, right there. So there it is in all of its sort of nice Baroque styling right there. The meeting of Abraham and Melchizedek, huh? A thing of beauty. Always got to have those well-fed angels up there. I always thought, man, those wings are working hard. All right. Let me show you, though, the slide I ripped off from the internet because someone already did the work. Here are just all the points. The writer is breaking it down for you. You got his name, what it means. You got that he's the king of... By the way, so Salem's a real place, but... So what's up? What's going on with that? Because he says king of peace like it's symbolic. Maybe it's both. I don't know. It's both. But notice some things he brings out about this guy. So he appears on the scene. We don't know anything about him. We don't get his backstory. We don't know his background. Who's he come from? Who's his daddy? Who's his family? Where did he grow up? Where did he get this privilege? Who appointed him? Who commissioned him? Where did he get this calling? How come he's a priest? And how is it Abram just recognizes it immediately? Doesn't question it. Just offers it to him, receives his blessing, and gives him and tithes to him. By the way, it's a big deal. I mean, presumably he's bringing a lot of goods here, a lot of spoils of war. He gives him a tenth. I don't know, but how about that? There he is. He's just... And then, of course, the writer even adds to this mystery here, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, like a son of God. Whoa! Wait a minute. I don't see a lot of other characters. I don't see a lot of other people. I don't see a lot of other figures from the Old Testament narrative of whom that kind of thing is said. I mean, that's, you know, sounds almost a little blasphemous. I mean, how can you say a thing like that? But there's a point to be made. And so people have always read this, and they've always been captivated and provoked to wonder, is this some kind of appearance? Is this what, to borrow the $2 theological word, is this what they call a Christophany, right? An appearance of Christ, the pre-incarnate, you know, from way back. Or I've heard some people say, well, maybe it's not Christ himself per se. Maybe it's a theophany, God appearing. Or, you know, he says like, so this is sort of a type. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of typology, but a type of Christ. That is, from, you know, there's the Greek word typos, or sort of means like a stamp or something that is emblazoned, or when you like you hit something with a club, you leave an indent on it. So it's something that mirrors and has a stamp on it. Is he a type? He's something. I mean, he's not just average. He's not just a average garden variety ancient king. He's way more. He's, however we construe it, he's divine. He's divine. Was he Christ appearing? Is he the Father, the Son? Is he mysterious, the angel of the Lord? That kind of thing. We see this in the Old Testament. But for sure, he's not just anyone. He's not just another one. You got the king of Sodom over here. Okay, you got this king over there. A king over here. Yeah, sure. This guy? No. He's of a different sort. And it's interesting what he says here. Just to put the point on it about his place and importance and his role. He says, you know, all the Jews knew, all of Israel realized the importance of the priesthood and the priest and the temple and the high priest. But that stuff doesn't exist yet. That stuff doesn't exist. You know, we sometimes might forget that none of the patriarchs we read about, and all the figures we know all the stories about, you know, Abraham and Isaac, and you got Jacob, you know, and his brother Esau, and then all of his sons, and then there's little Joseph, right? And then all that. We forget that all those people that take up most Genesis, none of them knew about the law. It didn't exist. None of them had the law. None of them knew the law. None of them ever sat and recited the Ten Commandments, because the Ten Commandments hadn't been given. By the way, that doesn't mean they didn't understand the basic moral truths of the Ten Commandments. It means that it just hadn't been put on stone so that they would actually call them that. They had never been, they didn't have a Sabbath per se officially given. They didn't go to a temple. They didn't have a priesthood formally. They didn't do the feast days. They never celebrated Yom Kippur. They existed before all that. Before all that. And it's interesting that he says, that Melchizedek says, I represent God Most High. I find it pretty interesting the writer of Hebrews went ahead and said, described Melchizedek the same way. Well, what of it then? Well, Abram then, and this may be a bit of a stretch. It's sort of interesting to think of. When we talk genealogy, when we talk genes, okay, and we talk lineage, and we talk descendants, consider what he's saying when he says, this priest, okay, the Levites haven't come. There's no Levites yet. There's no Levi yet. There's certainly no Aaron yet. He's going to come later. They don't exist yet. But, in a sense, they're present. Because great-granddaddy Abraham had many sons, and many sons had great-great-great-granddaddy Abraham. See, he's there, and hey, I'm not making this up. I read it. We saw it. He says, one might even say that Aaron, and then before him Levi, and in that sense all the Levites, every Levite who ever served, every priest who ever served, every great high priest who ever held that special office, all of them are there in the DNA of Abraham. He didn't say DNA, because at the time of this writing, the double helix had just not quite yet been discovered. But that's what he means. When he said, the quaint little in the loins, he means in the genes. In the genes. They're there. So you see what he's saying? In a sense, Levi, later Aaron, every Levite, every high priest, all of them, they're all submitting to this priest. They're all paying their tithe to this priest. This priest is superior to all of them. Superior to the entirety of the priesthood. Top to bottom. The whole thing taken together. This priest is superior. That's what he's saying. Which, of course, just goes to the writer's main point. The same point we've seen week after week studying this book. Which is that Jesus, the Messiah, surpasses as he fulfills everything. He fulfills it, he completes it, and he surpasses it, and he's greater than all of it. This king is eternal. He sits on David's throne forever. He'll never vacate it. And now he's also, while he's the eternal king on a throne, he's the eternal high priest in the temple. And the final one. The final king, because no king will ever come and sit there. And the final priest. He'll never die and be replaced by the next priest. The final, perfect, eternal priest. That's his point. He is the single holder of this divine priesthood. By the way, as a footnote, some of you remember it's not like you talk about Melchizedek very often in any church unless you come across these passages. But we, in fact, on one Wednesday night, we spent a little time discussing Melchizedek on one of our Wednesdays. And why did we, of all things? Why did we? Well, because in our ongoing study of different religious groups, we did spend a few weeks discussing the doctrine of those Latter-day Saints, a.k.a. the Mormons. And you might remember that I said to you, and some of you scratched your head and said, huh? I said, they do these two priesthoods because their founder looked in the Bible and said, you got this regular priesthood, the one that's Aaron's descendants, and you got this other guy, because he just knew enough to find Hebrews 7. And he said, there's another priesthood. Cool, it's even better. And so he instituted for his religious group two priesthoods. He said, we're bringing back the old Jewish regular priesthood, the Levitical one, the descendants of Aaron, and we're also instituting the Melchizedek one too. And so, in their world, every male, as long as you're in good standing, as long as you're a good, faithful member and contributing and whatever, you can have both priesthoods. You could walk around saying, I'm a priest. Oh, you mean the kind like a descendant of Aaron? Yeah. Also after the order of Melchizedek. I'll tell you this. When I first heard that, when I very first encountered that doctrine, I've told friends of mine this too, who happen to be Mormon. I've said, that alone, that all by itself, was enough to at once and immediately demonstrate to me, without question, that something was way wrong with this whole doctrinal scheme. That all by itself. Why? Because by the time I encountered that, I had read a lot of the Bible and I had learned the Greek and stuff. I'd done all my schooling. I'd been to seminary. So I had gone through this passage and tried to understand it. And when I first laid eyes on that teaching that they had, it was a deal breaker. Without anything else. It all by itself, it was a big, giant red flag telling me, okay, there's a lot of weird, made-up stuff here. Whatever else I might think of it, it doesn't even sniff the biblical teaching on priesthood. I mean, it's not even in the right zip code. Because this priest, that priesthood, the Melchizedek one, belongs to one person only. It never has belonged to anyone. It belonged to Melchizedek. Okay, whoever and whatever he was. But as the writer of Hebrews indicates, there's a good suggestion there that we're talking about the same person still. Right? So he never dies. And that's his real point. That's the application to believers. You might, because some of you are going, oh boy, whoo, a lot of theology today. But just in case you haven't sensed the application, this is the application. The application is that you need a priest.
Well, I don't need no priest.
Oh, yes, you do. I said last week, we believe in the priesthood. We sure do. Maybe not the guys in the collars. Okay, that's when you think priesthood, you got to think bigger. You got to think Bible. And as we said last week, there is in the New Testament a high priest, and there is also a priesthood, it's mentioned a couple of times, that belongs by virtue of the accomplishment of Christ. There is a priesthood that now belongs to every single Christian, every believer. Now is a priest to the extent that that scary veil that separated God from everybody, what happened to it? The symbolism couldn't be clearer. The way is opened. You can walk into the holiest place with boldness now, with confidence now. You can walk in there. You don't have to hold that office anymore, the one man held. So that's his point. Christ is the high priest. He surpasses all others. And you need a priest. And you have a priest. Because I don't know about you, but this is a pretty important role to play. I want, you know, the higher the stakes are, the more important it is to me that the person who's doing the thing I need has the qualifications. So, frankly, if you want to come to mow my grass, you feel free. Especially if you're David and you got those like mowers that drive 55 miles per hour. I'm going to ride one of those. I just want to see if one of them will drive right over a hedge. I won't really do that. But you know, if you want to mow my grass, I'm not going to ask for your resume. I don't need to know how much grass have you mowed. Do you have a degree in this? Are you? I got to be sure. I want to make sure. Because the stakes aren't that high. As long as you don't kill yourself, I don't care that much about that. That's not a big deal to me. But if you're going to operate on my vitals, I'd kind of like to know that you're good at that. Or if you're going to fly my jetliner, I kind of want to know you have some good training and maybe some hours of flight experience, because the stakes are high. Now, if you're going to be my intermediary who goes to God on my behalf to make me right with God, I'd like to know that I've got a good high priest. And so the good news here is that you got the best. There's nobody with higher qualifications. You got the high priest who is without beginning of days or end of life. You got the high priest who abides forever. He's also the king. He sits on an eternal throne, and his work's never done. He can't get tired, and he'll keep making intercession for you. And he won't tire doing it. That's the news. We have a priest. We have a divine priest. A forever priest.